This is the Inland Journal from Spokane Public Radio. I'm Doug Nadvornik. Today we'll devote most of the program to a conversation with Washington State Health Secretary John Wiesemann. Wiesemann is the state's top public health officer. He came to Olympia 4 years ago from Clark County, where he was the health officer there. He spent most of his career in public health, and he has thoughts about the direction in which his industry is headed. He calls it Public Health 3.0, a return back to the way it was a few generations ago. We started by asking him about his top priorities right now.
You know, my priorities, I would say, are two. One is modernizing the public health system. And modernizing the system really has four components to it. One is identifying these core services, which we have already done. The second is finding stable resources that can be adequate to fund the gap so that services can be provided. The third is working to make sure we're providing the services most efficiently and effectively in our 35 local health departments and with the state. And then finally, it's about upgrading our technology systems. We have data systems that are out of date, that are not giving us real-time information, and that doesn't serve anyone well. So I'm focused really on that modernization. A second thing that I'm focused very heavily on is trying to work with the legislature to raise the age of purchasing tobacco and vape to 21. And five states now have done this. We want to join those ranks. And the reason we want to do this is really to keep tobacco out of the hands of our 13, 14, 15, 16-year-olds, because we know that they're getting tobacco from those who are 18 and 19, their peer network that they're with in high school or that they're at after-school jobs with. That's really important because we know if kids don't start smoking by their early to mid-20s, they're not going to. And children's developing brains makes them much more susceptible to nicotine. So I would really like to see us be able to pass this legislation in Washington State. And we'll be back to the legislature to ask them to do that.
So as I recall, you had a bill that would have done that this year, and I haven't had a chance to look at that. How did that bill fare in the legislature?
Right. So this is the third time that we've asked, along with the Attorney General, to make this happen. Each year, we're getting more and more support. We're making it through more committees. But frankly, we believe if we could get that bill to the floor of the House and Senate, it would pass. And frankly, it's about getting it past leadership, particularly in the Senate. And again, we think this is the right thing to do for our kids, and we all need to step up and get that job done.
So I guess the argument there is, okay, you know, you can be 18 and join the military. You can't drink at 18, but you have so many things you can do at 18. Why do I have to wait until 21 to smoke a cigarette? Mm-hmm. So what's your argument?
My argument is, number one, if people can fight for their freedom, we want to fight for their freedom from tobacco. And that means keeping it out of the hands of our young kids. We know that raising the age to 21 will do that, and it's the right thing to do for our kids. And like you said, there are other things that we know. The developing brain really doesn't fully kick in terms of our cognitive and good choice making until our early 20s, mid-20s. And we do this with alcohol, and we do this with marijuana, that we say, hey, we're going to say that those are things that should wait at least until decision-making around age 21.
We all have this idea of what public health is, but how do you define what public health should be all about?
Great. Public health, really, if you think about it from just sort of a citizen perspective, is about the work people do to keep your food safe and your drinking water safe. It's about helping to prevent and stop disease outbreaks like Ebola or mumps or measles, those kinds of things. It's about helping to give children a healthy start, promoting breastfeeding and immunizations, for example. And then lastly, really, it's about also trying to prevent people from getting diseases like heart disease, stroke, cancer, that kind of stuff. So that's really the bread and butter of public health.
And is that different than what public health used to be?
You know, in the old days, public health used to provide a lot of direct services. So we used to provide well child clinics. We used to provide the actual immunization shots. A lot of us have gotten away from that. We're now really letting the healthcare delivery system do those services. And with the Affordable Care Act and more people having insurance, that certainly helps allow that to happen. So really now we're focused a whole lot more on sort of the bread and butter of public health, stopping those disease outbreaks, working with healthcare providers on immunizations, or frankly, working with the local PTA in school on how we can get safe routes to school for kids so that we can get walking back into their daily lives.
So is that the proper role of public health, or is there another direction you'd like to go?
We believe the proper role of public health is really where we're moving towards. We're fortunate to have a healthcare delivery system that can provide those services so that really we can focus on the prevention work. We can focus on keeping people healthy and well so that they actually don't need healthcare services. And we do that through what we call the core public health services.
So how is public health funded in the state of Washington?
Public health is funded through both federal, state, and local funds and fees as well. So tax dollar, you know, fees that are paying for these services. And services like restaurant inspections or septic systems are really a user fee, essentially. So there's a whole bunch of funding sources that we try to bring together and make into a coherent system.
Is that the best way to go?
Well, you know, we're really looking for this core funding, which is really key to our being successful. And it's the flexible funding that we really need to be able to put the dollars where they're needed in a community. So if a particular community has a big concern with whether it is sexually transmitted diseases or about, you know, immunization rates for kids, we can put that money where we need to put it.
So does that mean you're looking for more of a stable funding source from, let's say, the legislature every year so that you're not having to find and piece together different funding?
Exactly. We're looking for stable funding from the legislature. We wish to fund what we call these core services that should be available everywhere in the state. And right now, they're not available consistently, and that's creating inequities in the across the state. People who are living less longer in certain communities because they don't have basic services.
So what's the resistance to it then?
You know, I don't know that there's any real resistance to funding these core services. I think it's the challenge of finding the resources. And the challenge, of course, though, from our perspective, is that diseases don't wait for a convenient time to fund them. Yes, there are things like the McCleary piece where funding is needed and mental health resources that are needed. At the same time, public health needs resources. And so we're really pleased and fortunate that the legislature did appropriate $12 million towards this effort this year in what was a really tight budget year.
$12 million toward public health?
Towards public health for those core services. And we're going to focus those on communicable disease and hiring staff who can really respond more quickly to disease reports and work with community to stop them.
So what's the relationship between the state public health department and locals? I mean, Spokane has its regional health district, Ponderay, Stevens, and Ferry counties have their tri-county health district. What's that relationship like?
Great. The relationship with state and local public health in this state is that we have 35 local health departments. They're independently governed by local boards of health. The State Department of Health is separate from those. We really provide a lot of technical assistance. We provide services. So, for example, we have a state lab in Shoreline, which provides laboratory services certainly to state or local health departments, but also for things we do like testing shellfish to make sure that it's safe to harvest them, doing tests for communicable disease when we have outbreaks to see if we've got the same strain or different things going on. So the relationship of the state to the local is certainly we help provide funding resources to them from the federal that come to the state and the legislature. We get those resources out, technical assistance. And at the state, we manage some of the larger systems, for example, state drinking water, the really large public systems we regulate. Local public health regulates those individual wells that people might have. At the State Department of Health, we also regulate all the 400-some thousand health professionals in this state, doctors, nurses, psychologists, and their practice. And we regulate and oversee hospital facilities and dialysis centers and things like that. So it's a system that sort of works together, supporting each other.
And then how does the state work with the federal health CDC, Centers for Disease Control? I assume there are others as well.
Right. So certainly we work with the federal government in a number of ways. They have funding that helps fund whether it's a disease control efforts that come from the Centers for Disease Control, mental health services that come through the state, for example. We also report our data up to the federal government. So when we are having a communicable disease, whether it's a reportable condition around mumps or measles, then all that information also gets fed up to the national scene so they can get the national picture. So they're both, the federal is both a funder for us. They help direct policy. They also help identify what are some of those best practices that we ought to be implementing in states and in local communities.
So let's go back to this idea of public health 3.0. There are apparently some folks who want to go, I guess, in a bigger picture. I was reading an article that your aide sent to me regarding 5 strategic moves, and we're talking about from programs to populations. What does that mean?
Right. Well, a lot of, again, what we had been doing in the past in terms of programs was providing direct healthcare services, which we really have been getting out of. And so now we're looking at sort of looking at populations. So how do we help assure that children are born as healthy as they can be? Well, some of those are through services like making sure that we promote access to prenatal care, making sure that kids, when they're born, they're getting their vaccinations, and that we're working with healthcare providers to make sure they know when kids should be getting vaccinated, that they're getting the right vaccines at the right time, promoting breastfeeding. But even bigger than that is what we call this community clinical linkage piece. So think about asthma, for example. You can go to the doctor as a kid, get your medications for asthma, but when you go back into the community, if you go into a home that has mold in it, that has a lot of dust or leaky, you know, water pipes, those kinds of things, we're putting kids back into an environment that is unhealthy. So that's not something the physician or the nurse does, and so we work with public health to have folks who can go into the home, help people identify those triggers for asthma, to help, you know, even prevent them from needing their medication. So it's that sort of service that happens in the community, whether that be in the home, whether that be in a daycare center, a school, that we're really talking about working on.
So we'll finish with this. We're in wildfire season. We've seen smoke rolling through our state over the last couple of weeks. What's public health's role then in dealing with things like that?
Yeah, absolutely. Public health has a role around the air quality. We work with the air monitoring agencies across the state to monitor air quality. And then we work with communities around prevention messages and how to stay healthy. So we're particularly concerned about people who might have asthma or chronic heart disease with the smoke out there. Encourage people when to sort of stay indoors, how to exercise appropriately in this kind of environment, because we want people to stay healthy. We also have a role in working with the first responders and others in getting out, for example, masks if they're needed to the public to help prevent them from inhaling the particulate matters, and in working around evacuations that might be needed, for example, of communities and healthcare facilities, whether that's a hospital that might be in the way of a fire. So we have a role in helping to actually see to it that those patients can get transported to another place, safely taken care of. So again, if you think about this in terms of core services, in this case, it's about how do we keep people safe during an event that might make it unsafe for them, and how do we work with the other systems, healthcare systems, emergency management, and others in evacuations, keeping people healthy and making sure that they're safe.
John Wiesman is Washington's top public health officer. He's the secretary of the Washington State Department of Health. Four Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife employees have been fired after an investigation found an extremely sexualized culture at a fish hatchery on the Columbia River. This follows a previous investigation in 2015 into a sexualized workplace culture at Fish and Wildlife headquarters. Olympia correspondent Austin Jenkins continues our reporting on this issue in collaboration with the News Tribune of Tacoma. A heads up, this story describes sexual comments that aren't usually discussed on the radio.
The four employees were fired on August 7th after an investigation into allegations of misconduct and sexual harassment at the Wells Hatchery near Poteros, Washington. That investigation centered on three fish hatchery specialists and their manager. According to the report, the three specialists engaged in explicit sexual discussions at work, and their manager did nothing to stop it. The allegations included making sexual jokes, asking crude, inappropriate sexual questions of employees, and commenting on the bodies of women who visited the hatchery. One woman who worked there told investigators the atmosphere was, quote, way worse than anything she had encountered on fishing boats in Alaska.
I guess I was startled and taken aback.
This is Fish and Wildlife Director Jim Unsworth.
Behavior was occurring there that was certainly not acceptable in any workplace, and definitely not in Fish and Wildlife workplace.
Fish and Wildlife Commissioner Barbara Baker, who was appointed in January, was even more blunt.
The report was appalling.
Most of the examples in the report are too explicit to repeat on the radio, but here's a sampling of ones we can mention. The hatchery employee, who also worked on fishing boats in Alaska, was told she should prostitute herself on the boats to make a lot of money. Employees were referred to by sexualized nicknames, and they were asked graphic questions about their sex lives. In interviews, the men involved repeatedly referred to their behavior as locker room talk. They also denied many of the allegations. But Director Unsworth said there was enough evidence to justify the firings, and it's clear he hopes the action sends a message across the agency.
I think there will be some people that'll take notice that we were taking this seriously, and it won't be tolerated.
Commissioner Baker says the fact it took 3 years for someone to report the misconduct at the Wells Hatchery is a major concern. She's urging Unsworth to immediately implement a new sexual harassment training program for the entire agency.
This is a remote hatchery. The four top people who worked there have all been fired. But we need to have policies and procedures that assure that people feel comfortable if they can't report to the appropriate supervisor to report to someone else.
The Wells Hatchery investigation follows a 2015 investigation that involved members of the Fish and Wildlife Executive Management Team at headquarters. That report detailed a sexualized work culture there and followed the alleged rape of one employee by another. Baker, the newly appointed commissioner, says both investigations raise questions about the culture at an agency where nearly three-quarters of the employees are men.
Is there a glass ceiling for women in the agency? I don't have any idea. Are women leaving when they get to a certain level because they have other opportunity and they don't care for the culture in the agency? Again, I don't know. But I do know that people will be looking into that.
The Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife has about 1,900 employees. Director Unsworth took the helm in 2015 after a career with the Idaho Department of Fish and Game. He acknowledges challenges with recruiting more women and minorities into the ranks.
We're not experts on that. I'm not, and I, and a lot of my leadership aren't. But so it's probably would be worthwhile to hire people and see what other companies have done to do a better job.
Unsworth says the agency may consult a workforce diversity expert. As for the four employees who were fired, our efforts to reach them or their union lawyer were unsuccessful. All four have the right to appeal their firings through their union. I'm Austin Jenkins in Olympia.
You're listening to the Inland Journal from Spokane Public Radio. Cell phone towers in Oregon's Path of Totality were expected to overload this week. That's because of the thousands of visitors who would be taking selfies and uploading them to social media sites. But an unexpected consequence of cell coverage going down? Farm irrigation circles going dry, as correspondent Anna King explains from Haines, Oregon.
Joe Hill belts on his well-patinaed silver buckle every day to go to work. He won it with his Champion 4-H steer back in 97. Today, he's in a remote field in North Powder. He's trying to fix the broken sickle on his wheat combine. It's a three-man, one-woman job, and it's not going well. Also not going well during the middle of wheat harvest are Hill's irrigation circles. A circle pivot is a wheeled arm that walks around 120 acres or more, spraying water across the field. Farmers can set the rate so it passes over the ground very slowly or more rapidly. The new ones work off cell towers, so farmers can adjust that water right from their mobile phones.
Easy where you're swinging there.
Ever since the eclipse has been creeping up closer, cell companies like Verizon have been working to increase their capacity in the path of totality for the expected crowds. Verizon is one of the main companies that works out here and that farmers' fields are connected with. But that cell expansion work has already thrown off many of the irrigation circles on Verizon's service.
You know, we've got a great network of people that we work with, but, I mean, it's darn frustrating.
Verizon said in a statement, the eclipse is a once-in-a-lifetime occurrence, and they are expecting some challenges, but they have tried to upgrade their service wherever possible. Out here in this wheat field, Hill is worried about the eclipse. He expects major trouble for at least 4 days.
Well, in some cases, some of them we will be able to still have some control, and we can drive out and turn them on and turn them off. But some of them are wired, so the only way we can turn the water on and off and or change the speed is all based on that cell phone controlled unit. And so in those cases, it's going to be pretty challenging.
A piece down the road, outside of Haines, Jess Blatchford says he's ready for this gathering storm of eclipsers. Garth Brooks plays on his dusty farm shop radio while workers repair a chest-tall tractor tire. Blatchford, too, expects all his circles to go offline this week. He's got four-wheelers primed so he and his crew can run to each individual field on his 2,000-acre ranch and get the water back online manually. He's hoping his phone will still alarm when the circles shut off. Blatchford mainly grows processing spuds. Even a couple hot days off water can cause heat stress. With potatoes, it's hard to know what you've got until you dig them, but a few days without water could mean thousands of dollars lost on a single field, he says. But Blatchford is mainly worried about fire. He says it hasn't rained much here in weeks, and there's a lot of dry fields where eclipsers might try to pull off the road.
There's still a lot of stubble around, and you get people that don't understand that they don't need to be driving out through the fields, and it creates a pretty big fire hazard.
As for posting on Facebook, making calls, or Googling, Blatchford isn't too worried.
That doesn't worry me. If it quit for a day, it'd just be a pretty quiet day.
Like Blatchford, most farmers I spoke with said they don't mind giving up their solitude and sharing their dramatic mountain views for a few days with the visitors. They're just hoping there's enough bandwidth and blacktop to share. I'm Anna King, outside of Haines, Oregon.
Inland Journal is Spokane Public Radio's weekly public affairs program. It's heard every Thursday at 5 p.m. here on KSFC. You can hear our full programs or individual segments online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Go to the Inland Journal page. Thanks for joining us. I'm Doug Nadvornik.